This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
Traditions and forgotten struggles. I want to share with you a poem from Remember the Bridge, Poems of a People. The poem is called The Slave Storyteller, and I'm going to pass out just a couple instruments for us to use. You don't want to play the drum, you got to play it all the way through.
Yeah.
Delta's got rhythm. And I have two people to shake things with. You'll do this when I say the word glee, which is toward the end of the poem. When you hear me say birds, I'd like you to make a bird sound. When you hear me say heartbeat, I'd like you to rest your hand on your chest so you can feel your heart beating. When you hear me say ear, you would point to your ear. When you hear me say drum, you can pretend that your lap is a drum. And this is the way I share these poems with kids. So I'm trying to give you some ideas, some teaching ideas. When you hear me say thumb, you'll give a thumbs up. When you hear me say map, you pretend to be drawing with your hand. And I said diddly, that's that. Can you start drumming now? The Slave Storyteller. Gather round me, children. Behold my native land. Dream with me of Africa. The map drawn on my hand will chart the course through memories, reveal the roots of man. Deep within a forest where the drumbeat first began. Before there was music or even spoken word, when the only songs sung were melodies of birds, man turned his ear inward. A heartbeat's what he heard. He felt it pitter-patter, flutter, pulse, and pound. He moved to its rhythm, throbbing, thumping sound. From a hollow tree trunk, the tribesman carved a drum, stretched high across its head and wrapped it with his thumb. The drum echoed through the trees. Tribes called out ancient chants. The village leaped with glee in a ritual of dance. And my work often blurs the line between poetry, biography, historical fiction, and nonfiction. And I'm going to share with you some examples from each one of those categories, which, as I said, often overlap in my books. And so if you could advance. Okay. This is called Jazz Baby. And I call this my greatest hit. It is a nursery rhyme. It is a jazz pat a cake. And I don't care whether I'm in a middle school or an elementary school, you know, what grade, it doesn't matter what grade the students are in. If they've heard this poem, it is the poem that they most often request for me to read. So we're going to do a few things with our hands. When I say hands, you're going to clap two times. This is blow your horn, snap. You can tap. There aren't too many people. I don't usually have the kids tap because they get carried away. Pound your drum with lap drum in. When I say rum-a-tum-tum, you'll say rum-a-tum-tum. This is swing and sway. This is shake and shimmy, also jiggle wiggle. This is strike those keys. This is pluck those strings. You play guitar, bass guitar. When I say bebop da bop, you'll say bebop da bop.
Bebop da bop.
And this is let it rock you. Now, there's one other thing that you need to know. When I point to you, you're going to say jazz baby, jazz baby.
Jazz baby, jazz baby.
And that's actually how the poem starts.
Jazz baby, jazz baby.
Join the band. You've got music in your hands.
Jazz baby, jazz baby.
Blow your horn. You've got rhythm, sure as you're born.
Jazz baby, jazz baby.
Tap your feet. Snap your fingers. Happy feet.
Jazz baby, jazz baby.
Pound your drum. Hear it thump thump. Rum-a-tum-tum.
Rum-a-tum-tum.
Shake and shimmy, dance all day.
Jazz baby, jazz baby.
Strike those keys, make them clink clink if you please.
Jazz baby, jazz baby.
Cut a rug, jiggle wiggle.
bop,
bebop to bop,
jazz baby, jazz baby.
Hum a song, let it rock you all night long. Now, most of the poems that I share with students aloud are rhyming poems, but I do write free verse. Oddly enough, it often gets called lyrical prose by reviewers, but it is free verse, just the same. This is called Martin's Letter, and it is from Remember the Bridge. And I should at least hold the book up so you'll know what I'm reading from. This is from Remember the Bridge, and I'm not sure if we have Jazz Baby here. I don't think I see it. Yeah, Jazz Baby's a little tiny square book. Martin's Letter. Though sermons rolled off his tongue, Martin could not find words to tell his little brown girl why Funtown's gates were closed to her, or that the colored only sign on the drinking fountain didn't mean the water was a different hue. But in a jail cell in Birmingham, he found words to tell the holy men why he would not halt the marches. He would rather fight off police dogs and face fire hoses than wipe his daughter's tears. It's actually my favorite poem from Remember the Bridge. Let's moving along to historical fiction. I'm going to share Birmingham 1963 with you. I don't know whether it's not my most acclaimed book, but next to Moses, it is my most acclaimed book. It tells the story of the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham through the eyes of a 10-year-old narrator whose birthday happened to be on the day that the bombing took place. Birmingham, 1963. The year I turned 10, I missed school to march with other children for a seat at White's Only lunch counters. Like a junior choir, we chanted, "We shall overcome." Then police loosed snarling dogs and fire hoses on us, and buses carted us 900 strong to jail. The year I turned 10, Mama, Daddy, and I stood at Lincoln's feet while King's Dream woke the nation from a long night of wrongs. Some evenings I dozed on Mama's shoulder during mass meetings at church. The grown-ups were making big plans. The day I turned 10, I rehearsed my youth day solo in the full-length mirror. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. My little brother sopped red-eyed gravy with biscuits and yanked my pigtails like always, poking out his tongue when I tattled. But Mama allowed me my first sip of coffee, and Daddy twirled me around in the kitchen in my patent leather cha-cha heels. Then our whole family piled into the car that Daddy had washed and waxed the day before. We listened to gospel radio as we rode downtown. The day I turned 10, our church was quiet. No meetings, no marches. Mama left me in Sunday school with a soft kiss and coins for the offering plate. The teacher read a psalm, told a Bible story, and led a favorite hymn. Jesus loves the little children. I could hardly wait for church service to begin, to stand in the pulpit and sing from my heart. I would have followed four big girls to giggle in the restroom if I thought they'd include me. The day I turned 10, someone tucked a bundle of dynamite under the church steps, then lit the fuse of hate. Seconds later, a blast rocked the church. Smoke clogged my throat, stung my eyes as I crawled past crumbled plaster, broken glass, shredded Bibles, and wrecked chairs, yelling, "Mama! Daddy!" Scared church folk ran every which way to get out. That bomb left 21 hurt, and those four girls, Cynthia, Denise, Carol, and Annie Mae, dead. "This is my sister," a boy cried. "My God!" 10:22 a.m., the clock stopped, and Jesus' face was blown out of the only stained glass window left standing, the one where he stands at the door. "The Lord is my shepherd," said the pastor on a megaphone. The day I turned 10, I saw blood spilled on holy ground, and my daddy cried for the very first time. What had those girls done to deserve this? At supper, no one had much appetite. Afterwards, Mama washed and I dried dishes while she hummed, "Nobody knows the trouble I've seen." By evening, stonings, shootings, and fires broke out. "Keep your children inside," the police warned. I wondered if I could ever play outside again. I prayed myself to sleep that night. "Please protect my family, Lord. God, give four angels wings." The day I turned 10, there was no birthday cake with candles, just cinders, ash, and a wish I were still 9. The book actually ends with four poems under the title In Memoriam, tributes to each of the four girls who perished that day. I want to skip to move along to biography. And I'm going to read from I. Matthew Henson, which recounts the North Pole exploration and expeditions of Henson and Perry, which culminated in 1909. With their discovery of what was at that time at least thought to have been the North Pole. It's kind of, not so certain now whether they really made it, but they were closer than anyone else had come. Now, there is a little legend within this book, and the legend involves the devil of the North, known as Kokoya. So, when you hear me say Kokoya, you're going to have to be kind of monstrous. I'd like you to do this. Ah, be scary. I mean, even scary enough to scare the ghost out of here. When you hear me say polar bear, I'd like you to roar like a polar bear. When you hear me say anything that has to do with the dogs or sleds, which are known as sledges, I'd like you to say mush. And when you hear me say anything, any word that alludes to coldness, I'd like you to say So I'm starting in the middle. I did not befriend the Eskimos, learn to build a sledge, handle a dog team, track and hunt on ice, and kill a polar bear to let an Eskimo legend freeze me with fear. Kokoya, the devil of the North, guards the ice cap, the Eskimos warned. He is not real, I told them. After they danced and drummed, I played the accordion and sang hymns. I did not sail north with Perry 6 times through the frozen sea, charting the ice cap, inching toward the pole where no man had stood for frostbite to halt our mission. When ice took most of Perry's toes, I carried him back alive, Kokoya on our heels, howling in the wind. We had not braved the frozen wilderness, going miles beyond the last village only to starve because new snow hid our store of food. We tracked hare and musk ox until the hunting was poor and we were skin and bones. Then we ate our sled dogs, all but one. Kokoya churned in our guts. We had not faced sudden storms, frozen peaks and ridges, and shifting iceberg castles to let leads, patches of open water swallow us. With a quarter ton of supplies and an often lame Perry on a sledge, we crossed 20 miles in as many hours, snow pricking our faces, fingers burning with cold. We built igloos each night and dared Kokoya to stop us. I had not stuck by Perry for 2 decades, sharing the same goal, only to reach a fork when our journey was on its last leg. Task completed, team after relay team returned to base camp. In the end, Perry picked me to go all the way, vowing he could not make it without me. Kokoya would be no match for us. We had not trudged on, rushing across the ice pack with 4 Eskimos to let faulty instruments steer us wrong. I used dead reckoning to guide us north. Sluggish from the cold, Perry sent me ahead. Miles later, I stopped the sledge, wiped my frozen lashes, and scanned the vast sheet of ice. I was close. Shortly, Perry arrived, and we broke through the thin ice. He did a sounding, lowered 9,000 feet of rope into the ocean. 6 men, 1 black, 1 white, four Eskimos had reached the North Pole. We had found what we hunted, I said in Inuit. A camera froze our feet in time, but we had not come for photos. We came to plant our flag, and Kakoya was nowhere in sight. Next slide. I've written quite a bit of nonfiction. Some of it's too boring to even read here. I've got a couple reference books. Well, the African American struggle for legal equality, for example, is, you know, education publisher reference book. The rest of them aren't boring. Sink or Swim is a true adventure about a team of lifesavers in North Carolina who waded and swam through a hurricane to bring nine survivors ashore. And the lifesavers didn't get gold medals at the time. They were the only all-black lifesaving crew in North Carolina at the time. This is around the turn of the century, 1896. They got posthumous gold medals in 1995. I want to share just a few lines with you from Negro League Scrapbook, which combines a poem about the Negro League with sidebars that have trivia about, statistics, some profiles, and just little vignettes about what life was like at that time for the players of the Negro Leagues. With all that's combined with photos, historic photos, probably about 80 historic photos. And let's see, this is a Negro League scrapbook. Oddly enough, a lot of senior citizens buy this book. And one person who purchased the book said, well, you know, it's the tone is sophisticated enough that an adult could read it. And the type is big, so you don't, it doesn't strain the eye. So a lot of senior citizens have bought it. I'm just going to read an excerpt from the poem, not the entire poem. A Negro League scrapbook. Major League bans black and brown. Negro League's a proving ground. Monarchs, Barons, Giants, Grays, all black baseball's glory days. Long lean satchel, bag of tricks. B-balls buzzing, strike out six. Cool, cool papa swats a fly, then like lightning flashes by. Hammer, grand slam, mighty swing, Hank hits like a home run king. Triple headers last past dusk, ride on, barnstorm, rumbling bus. Jackie Robinson smacks the ball, toppling segregation's wall. Bronze their portraits, etch their names upon the wall at the Hall of Fame. Now, I've written quite a few books about the freedom struggle, either the freedom struggle during slavery times or during the Jim Crow era. My best known and most successful book is Moses, When Harriet Tubman Led People to Freedom. It was illustrated by Kadir Nelson, all-star artist who just was in USA Today's Weekend magazine last weekend. I just saw the article, so I was really privileged to have been able to work with Kadir. I think, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I think I'll start out somewhere along her journey to freedom. And what I'd like you to do is, when I do this, I'd like you to repeat one of whatever line I just said, one of Harriet's lines. The story, which is told through free verse, unfolds through three in a narrative that includes three voices: Harriet's voice, God's voice, and the narrator's voice. Harriet walks till her legs ache. Then she leans against a tree. Lord, I miss my folks.
Lord, I miss my folks.
Harriet, your father taught you to read the stars, predict the weather, gather wild berries, and make cures from roots. Use his lessons to be free. You will meet again. A mosquito buzzes in Harriet's ear. She rises and moves on. A boatman rows her upriver. Back on shore, hounds snarl, sniff for Harriet's trail. She races as fast as she can. Lord, I can't outrun them.
Lord, I can't outrun them.
God speaks through a babbling brook. Shed your shoes, wade in the water to trick the dogs. Upstream, the barking ceases and fear washes away. Thank you, Lord.
Thank you, Lord.
Harriet's feet bleed and her gut churns. Under the stars, she draws near to God. Lord, don't let nobody turn me round. I'd rather die than be a slave. Harriet, keep going. You have already glimpsed the future. She recalls dreams where she flew like a bird, sank and was lifted by ladies in white who pulled her north. Fly, Harriet, your faith has wings. Up ahead, she hears word that patrollers are nabbing runaways and crouches for days in a potato hole. Dreams she is buried alive. Have you deserted me, Lord?
Have you deserted me, Lord?
Harriet, when you were a girl, you hid in a pig pen to shun the whip. You fought hogs for table scraps, almost starved before you faced the lash. I am with you now as I was then. An old prayer comes back to her. Lord, make me strong. Help me fight.
Lord, make me strong. Help me fight.
After 7 days, Harriet rises from that hole like a sapling, reaches for the sun as if to touch God's hand. By moonlight, she marches on, making her way mile after rugged mile, hiding in haystacks, attics, and barns, holding God's hand all the while. She often wearies. How far, Lord?
How far, Lord?
As far as you can walk with me, my child, and I can carry you. When Harriet is about to drop, a couple in a wagon ride by. They say slavery is a sin, and they take her on the last leg of her journey. Not far now, child, not far now. In the promised land, Philadelphia, the sun shines gold in the trees, and Harriet feels light as a cloud. She studies herself from head to toe to see if she has wings. Is this heaven, Lord?
Is this heaven, Lord?
Not heaven, Harriet. Free soil. But freedom brings new woes. Lord, I am a stranger here. All my kin are down south. Would you like to see them? As Harriet does, her family's faces appear in the wood grain. She wipes a tear from the table. I would make a home for them here. I would give my own life to free them. Then go back for them, daughter, but first go to my house to prepare for the journey. And Harriet goes to church, finds not just holy ground, but a stopping place, a station along the Underground Railroad that slaves travel to freedom. Harriet hands out shirts and shoes, serves butter beans and biscuits to newly arrived runaways, while agents who plot escape paths pass on secret routes that she learns by heart. Finally, a conductor, a guide, she turns to God. I am ready, Lord, lead me.
I am ready, Lord, lead me.
Harriet, I will make a way for you. Risking her own life, Harriet returns to the dreaded South and rescues her family, but she dreams of slaves still in the yoke. She hears their groans, sees their tears, tosses and turns in her sleep. Then God opens her eyes. Harriet, be the Moses of your people. But I am a lowly woman, Lord.
But I am a lowly woman, Lord.
Harriet, I have blessed you with a strong body, a clever mind. You heal the sick and see the future. Use your gifts to break the chains. I will do as you say, Lord. I will show others the way to freedom that you have shown me. Save all you can, daughter. And Harriet heeds God's call, goes south again and again, keeps her bands of runaways moving, come storms and rough country, clear to Canada, Canaan land. And when free souls sing her praises, she gives glory where it is due. It wasn't me, it was the Lord. I always trust him to lead me, and he always does. Well done, Moses. Well done.
Well done, Moses. Well done.
Of course, if you have if you know about Harriet Tubman, you recognize that many parts of this story are true. Of course, the conversations with God were constructed by me, but they are based on her own testimonies or testament in her autobiography, her narrative. Harriet Tubman, something in the life of a slave woman, written by Sarah Bradford in the 1860s. So I didn't, you know, it's not totally imagined, but of course I did take license because I constructed the interior monologue that Harriet was having with herself and had to construct some of the conversations with God. Certainly I had to, you know, come up with what God said to her. But, you know, on occasion, you know, Harriet did believe that God talked to her and that she could speak to him as friend to friend, and that is what inspired this book. All right, moving on to we're on the freedom struggle now, that's right. Okay, moving on to sports. Jesse Owens, I don't know how I got started writing about sports, but I wrote a Negro League scrapbook, and I don't have the dust jacket, but the jacket flap made me out to be a big baseball fan. But I guess that worked for the publisher. You know, they needed to say that to market the book, perhaps. Then, next thing I knew, I was writing Champions on the Bench, which is about a little big team in the 1950s that won its the South Carolina state championship by default because none of the white teams would play on the field with this team. And the team, the Cannon Street All-Stars, went to the Little League World Series but could not compete at the World Series because they had won by default, and that was a rule. You had to win on the field, not by, you know, the forfeit of default. So I wrote that book, and so that was my second baseball book. And when I was a kid, I was always the last one chosen when you had to choose teams to play softball because everybody knew I was going to strike out. And then I found myself writing Jesse Owens' Fastest Man Alive. That was actually the idea of Eric Velasquez, an illustrator that I have worked with, whom I have worked with several times. This was our second book together. Matthew Henson was our third. So Eric asked me if I'd be willing to write a book about Jesse Owens at the 1936 Olympics. So I'm going to read a poem to you that is not so much about Jesse Owens' feat at the Olympics, but about someone like me, a writer at the 1936 Olympics. And this past summer, I went to Berlin, and I was actually able to go to the stadium, the 1936 Olympic Stadium. So the poem is called Headlines, and there are a few things I'd like you to repeat after me in the poem. The Black Arrow, Black Bullet, Black Panther, and Whirlwind. And I'd like you to pretend that you're typing, if you can remember how you used to, if any of you have ever typed on a manual. It's not like a computer keyboard. Headlines. And this, I should tell you, this is the first book that I've written in second person. I haven't written anything else in second person lately. But I like to try new things, and that's what I tried with this. Headlines. After you clinch the gold, 100 cameras flash. Your name is on newsmen's lips. Fast fingers tap typewriters, pecking praise from France to Finland. The writers rave, call you the Black Arrow.
The Black Arrow.
Black Bullet.
Black Bullet.
Black Panther.
Black Panther.
Whirlwind.
Whirlwind.
Presses around the world rush extra editions. Headlines hailing your new record leave readers breathless. But you cannot let fame swell your head or fog your sight. You have races yet to run and history still to write. And now I'm going to read just a couple, maybe one poem from Dear Mr. Rosenwald. We're going on to the next slide, which should be Family and Community. Dear Mr. Rosenwald refers to Rosenwald schools. The Rosenwald in the title is Julius Rosenwald, who was a president of Sears in the early 20th century, who was a philanthropist, And he also was a member of the Tuskegee Institute Board of Trustees. So he was, you know, a close friend of Booker T. Washington. Mr. Rosenwald asked Booker T. Washington what he thought he should do with his money, how he could help with his money. And as you know, Booker T. Washington was a big advocate of education. And he said, well, you can fund the building of schools throughout the South. So Mr. Rosenwald's fund, which is known as the Rosenwald Fund, provided seed grants to rural communities, most of which were rural African American communities throughout the South, to build schools. In many communities, they were the first schools ever to be, you know, ever to serve those communities, first public schools. In other communities, the Rosenwald schools replaced schools that had been built during the Reconstruction era by missionaries or by the Freedmen's Bureau. So the seed grants usually were about average $600. The communities themselves had to raise matching funds, usually which exceeded $600. And they also had to provide the labor, the sweat equity to build the schools and secure land on which to build the schools. The state had to also agree that they would administer the schools once they were constructed. So I want to read Passing the Plate, which is my favorite poem out of the collection, and it's about literacy. Homecoming Sunday, a church full. Uncle Bo didn't need to preach a sermon after going on about the new school. Said, we're gathering money, a nickel and dime at a time. The ushers passed the plate. Afterward, Uncle Bo waved envelopes white neighbors sent, $20 in all. Then the choir sang, the Lord will make a way somehow. Just before service ended, Miss Etta May asked to have a word. I was born a slave, worked hard even before freedom came. Never had time for book learning. Here's a dollar for money I've been saving for my burial. Hurry and build that school so I can learn to read my Bible. And I'll read the last poem from that book also. It's the title poem, Dear Mr. Rosenwald. Even before the bell rang, we children lined up at the door, me with bows in my hair and ham biscuits in my lunch pail. I share a desk with Lottie May. Miss Shaw got busy right away. Our first lesson, letter writing. Dear sir, I am 10. I like to read books. My best subject is arithmetic. My parents are counting on me to learn all I can. This school is the first new thing I ever had to call my own. I'm going to stitch me a dress in the sewing classroom. One day, I'll be a teacher like Miss Shaw. Thank you, Mr. Rosenwald. Yours truly, Ovella. My favorite theme by far, are we ready for the next slide, is jazz. I've written about jazz probably more than I've written about any other subject. I probably have my father to thank for that. He was a jazz fan who had a jazz record collection. And when I was for the 10 years that I was an only child, I entertained myself with his record collection. So I was introduced to some of the standard bearers of jazz royalty. Well, I'll talk about in a little while. One artist that he didn't have though was John Coltrane. I live in High Point, North Carolina, which is where John Coltrane was raised and spent just about all of his childhood. So I've been in High Point for several years, had written an adult poem about John Coltrane, and decided, well, nobody's written a book about John Coltrane, although Chris Roshka has written the book Giant Steps about a John Coltrane composition. I wanted to write a book that was really, about the man himself. So at first I said, well, I started trying to write this biography, and I thought, no, it doesn't fit John Coltrane. What I really wanted to write was a jazz riff. So I came up with this poem that was 167 words long, and it's the recurring phrase is also the title, Before John Was a Jazz Giant. So when I point to you, I'd like you to say, Before John Was a Jazz Giant.
Before John was a jazz giant.
Okay, I'm going to show you a few things that you're going to need to do. This is strumming the ukulele. This is cranking a phonograph. That's the record player. It used to exist before, you know, CDs and three players. Whistle, when you hear me say whistling. Let's see. So when I say sermons, I'd like you to say amen. This would be mama playing hymns. Make a bird sound when you hear me say birds warbling. When you hear me say big bands, I'd like you to snap and keep snapping for a while. And then when you hear me say saxophone, I'd like you to play saxophone all the way to the end of the poem. The very last line, I'd like you to repeat after me. The last line is, he was all ears. Okay, ready? Before John was a jazz giant. And the first line of the poem is yours.
Before John was a jazz giant,
he heard ham bones knocking in grandma's pots, daddy strumming the ukulele, and mama cranking the phonograph.
Before John was a jazz giant,
he heard steam engines whistling past, cousin Mary giggling at jitterbuggers, and Bojangles tap dancing in the picture show.
Before John was a jazz giant,
he heard grandpa's Sunday sermons.
Amen.
Mama playing hymns for the senior choir, and the scoutmaster's call to join a band.
Before John was a jazz giant,
he heard birds warbling at sunrise, the sobs of kinfolk at family funerals, and cheers as he marched in parades.
Before John was a jazz giant,
he heard big bands on the radio, and a saxophone's soulful solo, blue notes crooning his name.
Before John was a jazz giant,
he picked up that horn, blew into the mouthpiece, pressed his fingers on the keys, and breathed every sound he'd ever known into a bold new song. Before
John was a jazz giant,
he was all ears.
He was all ears.
That book is illustrated by Sean Qualls, who is just a wonderful, wonderful illustrator, prize winning also. All right, my latest book, I would like for you to, if you can go to my website and get out of this PowerPoint presentation, becomingbillyholiday.com, www.becomingbillyholiday.com. And once you get there, I know I said I didn't need the laser pointer.
Okay.
But once you get there, I'm going to take you to my book trailer. Billie Holiday, while she's getting there, I'll tell you, Billie Holiday is my muse. My dad listened to Billie Holiday. I grew up, you know, when I was entertaining myself as an only child, listening to Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, and especially Dinah Washington. My father played her over and over and over and over, over again. So I knew how to sing those songs when I was really young. That's how I entertained myself. Billie Holiday became my muse around, I'm going to get you to click on book trailer in just a second. Billie Holiday became my muse sometime when I was in my 20s. Although I didn't acknowledge her as such until I was older. And a couple years ago, I came up with the idea, but I really think it was her idea, to write this book about Billie Holiday. And I was reluctant at first. I was excited at first. Then I told my husband, and he said, "Wow, no." He said, "You're always writing about something that, you know, is something that's going to be a hard sell." And he says, "Do you really think that teenagers are going to be, young adults are going to be interested in her?" And I said, you know, you're probably right, because I'm always writing about something very obscure, and, you know, you got to explain it to people and educate people about it before they'll buy the book. So I kind of just put it aside. Then I went to this place called the Great Blacks and Wax Museum in Baltimore. And I got up on the second floor. I was there, I had taken my son and a friend during spring break. I got up on the second floor, and there was this Billie Holiday exhibit. So I just stood there with the wax figure, and an eighth grade girl walked up and said, "Ooh, Billie Holiday." And I looked at her, she's young. She's a teenager. And I said to the wax figure, and it was almost as if the wax figure said, I told you so. And I just dove into the project after that. And the poems really, they literally poured out of me. Now remember the bridge, I don't know if I told you, I worked on for, off and on for 20 years. Becoming Billie Holiday, I started on after the spring semester was over. As preparation, when I was commuting to work during spring semester, I listened to the end of spring semester, I listened to her early CDs on the CD player in my car. Then when the semester was over, I started reading, you know, some biographies, and I had read some before, but I read the biographies, you know, with this book in mind. And when I stopped reading, well, I also had printed out a discography of her song titles. And as I read the biography, the song titles began to kind of provide musical settings for the poems that I was going to write. So all the songs in the collection are titled, all the poems in the collection are titled after her songs. And the poems are written in her voice. As I researched and wrote, it was almost as if she were whispering in my ear, whispering her story in my ear and humming in the background. As I wrote. So it's a very, you know, it's almost a mystical experience. So let's see the book trailer.
Okay.
Oh, you can't hear the audio.
Oh,
that's okay.
Joelle, just sing for us.
Okay. It's not her anyway.
What do you say? Sell the book, just stick a CD in there.
I know. That costs money, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But,
is there a CD you'd recommend?
Well, there are some songs in the back of the book that I recommend. I just love so much Billie Holiday that I have to compile my own, you know, from the 20 CDs that I have. Okay, so let me just read while that's going, since there's no audio. The first poem is called "Why Was I Born?" And it's the second poem in the book. Because Sadie, that's her mother, had one day off a week from her job as a live-in maid and crammed as many thrills as she could into the few hours she called her own. Cause teenagers flocked to the carnival in July for rides, cotton candy, and sideshows. Cause Clarence had rested his banjo for the evening, hoping to sneak a peek under the tent during the burlesque show. Cause he and Sadie bumped into each other at the hot dog stand and shimmied all night long in the sultry summer air. Cause Clarence whispered in Sadie's ear, sweet-talked his way right up her skirt. Cause that one time was all it took for two dumb kids to make a baby. Cause Sadie went to Philly with full belly to keep from shaming her Baltimore kin. Cause I could not wait a minute longer to burst on the scene. And 2:30 a.m. April 7th, 1915 was as good a time as any to gasp my first breath, cry my first chord, cause I no more chose my folks than chose my name, Eleonora. She was born Eleonora Fagan in Philadelphia and then was raised, she kind of raised herself in Baltimore. This poem's about her father, my first impression of you. Tall, dark, and dashing, distant relative passing through with empty pockets and promises. You pinched my cheeks and bounced me on your knee, but music was your sweetie pie. You were the envelopes Mom kissed, the letters she read over and over, and the dollar bill she tucked in her bra. You were the one she blamed when rent was due and I needed new shoes, the thief who stole her heart and her youth. A happy-go-lucky banjo playing, whiskey swinging papa, gone in the blink of an eye. And this is called A Fine Romance, and it's actually about her reading preferences. She liked to read pulp fiction and pulp fiction magazines. So you'll hear me within the poem, I have interwoven some story titles from pulp fiction magazines of her day. A Fine Romance. Not once upon a time, or happily ever after, but the lurid scenes I savored in salty love comics and tawdry true confessions. Titillating headlines whetted my appetite. Love letter Romeo, don't call me darling. In the looking glass, I dance alone. The day before paradise, there has to be moonlight. One crowded hour, my heart wore wings. Saucy thoughts simmered to a slow boil, gripping me in a steamy embrace. Sure, my tastes were lowbrow, but at a dime a serving, these cheap thrills made real life seem bland. Strewn around my bedroom, piles of pulp fiction, love book, true story, real tempting tales, bonbons I devoured as midnight snacks. Then we're going to skip ahead. She eventually, of course, changes her name to Billie Holiday. And she toured with several bands, one of which was the Count Basie Band. This is called Detour Ahead. Touring with Count Basie meant headlining at hotels where we couldn't sleep and playing one-nighters at juke joints and dance halls where some drunken fool might knife a woman, over a two-timing woman. Playing with Basie's big band meant riding a Blue Goose bus all day and night, passing vacancy signs aimed at whites only till we reached a black hotel or rooming house where we could rest our tired bones. Traveling with Daddy Basie meant being the only girl among 16 guys, learning to shoot craps from old hands, and then kneeling with Lady Luck till I wore holes in my hose and beat those boys at their own game. Being part of Basie's band meant cutting up with Prez, treating the fellas to my home cooking, and when they gambled their pay away, coming to their rescue with loans for sweethearts' Christmas gifts. Working for the Count meant being shorted on payday, not having cash for a hot dog, and never having the right clothes, equipment, or instruments, but always having the right sound. Swinging with Basie's band meant barely being able to read a note between us, yet knowing 100 songs by heart. 17 musicians playing by ear and breathing as one. Count Basie's big band was the jazziest party on wheels. And the last poem in the book, Coda, Strange Fruit. The book ends on a high note. Any of you who know Billie Holiday's life story know that she had, you know, a somewhat tragic life and met a, you know, tragic demise. But I wanted to end the book because it's a young adult book. One, before she got married, so it had to be at 20, because she got married, you know, shortly after that. So it ends on at age 25, which coincidentally is also before she got hooked on heroin and, you know, kind of began her decline. Coda, Strange Fruit. After years of being barred from entering front doors, sitting on bandstands and mingling at whites-only clubs, how could I not headline Cafe Society, one of the first joints to let blacks and whites mix? After being called nigger wench down south and high yellow in Detroit, how could I resist the chance to sing in my own skin? After a cigarette sponsor cut me from his radio show, how could I not yearn to again breathe free? After moving from place to place as a child, how could I not relish a long run in Greenwich Village, New York's hippest haunt? How could I not thrive at a place where the owner, an ex-shoe salesman, worshiped the ground I walked on, and waiters asked noisy patrons to leave rather than disturb my show? When the NAACP hung the flag, a man was lynched yesterday from its 69th Street office, how could I not long to voice outrage? When school teacher Lewis Allen showed me his protest poem about a lynching and plucked a somber melody on the piano, how could I let that tune slip away without passing through my lips? When the waiter stopped service, the room was pitch black except for a spotlight on my face, and I stood completely still performing Strange Fruit, how could I not shed tears? When I arrived at Cafe Society, a girl singer with a string of hits, and departed the star of the hour, how could I not claim, this is my song. Thank you so much.
There are four seasons in each year, winter, summer, spring, and fall. Which one do you like best of all? I like winter. That's when the wind gives its pleasant call. My mother was so surprised when I said that. She parked the car. We were just two blocks from home by then. And she said, can you say that again? And I said it the second time, she wrote it down. And I had actually forgotten it, except when until I began to do school visits, and the kids said, what was your first poem?
Oh, yeah.
And I went back to my mom, and I said, you know, do you still have that poem I wrote? And she pulled this raggedy old envelope out of her dresser drawer. She said, it might be in here. And sure enough, it was. I mean, all the things that your mother had on the refrigerator when you were going to school might come back to haunt you.
We hope. Other questions?
Yes.
Karen in the back.
Can you tell us about the closet?
Much more hard work than the Billie Holiday manuscript was. But you know, I feel that this is what I was meant to do. You know, just as Harriet felt like she was called by God to become a conductor on the Underground Railroad, I feel that I was called by God to do this. And I feel that I not only have a responsibility to write about things that, sometimes obscure subjects that, you know, may not sell a whole lot of books all the time, but are nevertheless important to write about. And of course, you know, submitting my work is not only a way for me to publishers, is not only a way for me to get paid, but to ensure that other people can benefit from what I've learned through the research that I've put into my writing.
Yes, you have a question?
Yes.
What authors do you find most inspiring?
I can tell you some whose work I enjoy. Langston Hughes says he's just the top for me. I was introduced to him in elementary school, not in person. Not by the time I was born, but by the time I was introduced to his writing, he was about gone. I just love the way that he used African American vernacular in his writing, and I continue to read his work. Now, I can tell you one writer whose work kind of changed the way that I looked at poetry, and that writer is Antozaki Shange. When I was right out of college in my 20s, my father and I went to see For Colored Girls Who Consider Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. And at that point, I had been to, you know, some poetry meetings, but I had never envisioned poetry as necessarily an oral art form until I saw that play, and that just changed. It really changed my life as far as changed my writing life. And I don't even think I was a committed writer at that point. But I think it was either sometime shortly after that or right before that I had written a poem called "I'm Made of Jazz," which at that time was the longest poem that I had ever written. It was a 3-page poem, and it poured out of me. Many of the poems in Becoming Billie Holiday. Now, at the time when I wrote that poem, I was about to go to grad school on a fellowship, Public Administration,
And I went to grad school, and I went to one class. gave back all the pile of research assistantship stuff that I was supposed to be working on. Gave it back to the professor, and at that point I began declaring myself a poet. So there are really three poems in my literary career. The one that really changed my life. One, of course, was the little poem about the seasons, when my mother wrote down the poem. That poem, I think, was God's way of helping my parents to recognize that I had this gift. And my dad was a printing teacher. I've got to give him some props, because he printed some of my early poems on little index cards. Not a book, but just on index cards. So at a very early age, in the 1960s, before there were desktop printers, desktop computers, I saw my work in print. When everybody else was just seeing their work, if they were lucky, in typewriter print, I saw my work in real print. So that was that first poem that my parents knew that they had, they really had something on their hands. And then when I wrote the poem in my 20s, early 20s, about jazz, called I Made a Jazz, I think that was God's way of saying, okay, wait a minute, you're not supposed to be going into public administration. I made you a poet. And it would be 20 years, it would be almost 20 years before my first book was published. But I persisted, and then I wrote Moses, which after I read the book, Moses by no means poured out of me. I worked on that book off and on for probably 7 years or more. But when it was published, I kind of read it and thought, oh, you wrote that? it's 2 years, of course, it's 2 years after you've written something, but Moses was my most successful book. It was also my first book that really dealt with spirituality. And the last line in the book, you remember, is "Well done, Moses, well done." That book has sold more than 100,000 copies. And I think that book is God's way of saying, "Well done, Carol, well done." So, thank you.
And I think we'll just close by saying, thank God you listened. Yeah. Amen.